You're listening to Pushing the Envelope, Life at the Cutting Edge of Customs Innovation. I'm Tom Muller with the Cross Border Research Association. On this show, we explore the frontiers of customs creativity in conversations with customs and logistics experts, technology innovators, research scientists, and other leaders in the field. Industry insiders call this show the PennCast because it's part of PennCP, a network for boosting customs innovation funded by the European Union under the Horizon 2020 program. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Damien Romestand, an international expert in the areas of financial crime, anti-corruption, compliance, economic sanctions, and export controls. Dr. Romestand earned his PhD in law from the University of Montpellier in France with a thesis on the roles played by export controls and the international sanctions in the regulation of strategic goods and products. Today, Dr. Romestand wears many hats. Among other things, he works for and consults with private companies in the compliance space. He's a founding member of Le Cercle K2, K2 Circle, a French not-for-profit organization with members from over 30 nations that furthers nonpartisan international dialogue. And he's head of economic sanctions for the Corporate Crime Observatory, in which capacity he's speaking with us today. Dr. Romestand, Damien, if I may, thank you for joining me today on the PennCast.
Hi, Tom, and thank you for inviting me.
It's anyone who looks at your background and your ongoing work will be struck by the range of projects and activities you're engaged in and how many of those areas of expertise are vitally relevant, and you might say, alas, vitally relevant to the huge geopolitical challenges the world faces today. To start off with, a word about your background.
I got my degree from the University of Montpellier in south of France, as you mentioned. And it was in the early 2000s where I started to work on globalization and the role played by export controls within the globalization. So at that time, we were very few working on these topics in France, and most of the literature was coming from the US. So that was very challenging for me to find the substance and the documentation. And I'm glad to see how 20 years after this research is now, the topics are much more spread around the globe.
Would you say that it's almost inverted now, that the EU is producing as much of the literature as the US, or?
I would say equally. The roots are coming from the US, but there are many, I would say, indigenous, if we could say that, or national researches which are not disconnected, but much more independent from the production in the US.
And you earned your PhD in law from the University of Montpellier with a thesis in international trade and globalization, specifically how export controls and international sanctions regulate the flow of strategic goods and products. Could you describe that thesis briefly? And if you were to rewrite it today, what would your conclusions remain the same?
Ah, very good question. How to start with? So, when my professor proposed me this topic, I had first to think twice because I couldn't really see what we were talking about. And I think after 2 days, I was completely convinced that that was the topic to work on. Especially because it was at the intersection between trade, defense, national security. So that was the nexus interesting me. And during my researches, I first identified the legal framework, and then I've been lucky to have some doors opened within the industry, but also within the public officials to talk about the practice. And so that was the point of the document, the research, to put together this legal framework and how it was implemented in practice.
I see.
I had a conclusion at that time. Again, we were at the beginning of 2002, and there was a concept starting to appear called counterproliferation. So the conclusion was going into that direction that maybe NATO countries could lead future military intervention to counter the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, because at that time that was the main concerns.
Right.
So that's how I concluded this this work, and that's what you can find in the book published after the based on the thesis, which is still in the library, I think, a bit outdated.
What's the title of the book?
The title of the book is in French, Commerce et Sécurité.
Commerce et Sécurité, okay.
Les exportations sensibles dans la mondialisation.
Okay.
But this is trade and security, sensitive exportation within globalization.
Good.
So, completely outdated, but I was thinking about maybe writing a new edition or something like that.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so that sort of comes back to my question of how things would change 20 years, 22 years after. How would your conclusions change? That's a big question. But when you say it's outdated, what do you mean?
Now the main difference is that for years we had a very stable legal framework regulating all these transactions in sensitive technologies, goods, whatever. In the recent years, we could see so many changes, revisions arriving, and you have these changes also in how the regulation is operated. Before, it was much more on consensus. And now, with this political distanciation between different countries, you see that we have an emerging debate on the necessity to have maybe a new export control regime in place, not only to address new technologies emerging on the market, but also to address the issue of how to operate the trade transactions, including these technologies. Shall we apply the same rules with what are called the rogue states or not? And as long as export controls are based on mutual trust, it could be also complicated to stick to the usual rules or the same rules.
That's fascinating. Yes, mutual trust is something that's in short supply these days. we'll get into the a few specific areas in our conversation later, but this is your advisor, I would say, was a very wise person and proposed a very good topic, and timing is everything. You really hit
the timing. That's a good point, because now I think that it was a bit too much anticipated at that time. People were not ready, and that was actually, I can disclose it, I mean, that was one of the criticism I received from the academic world, that my thesis was too practical. But actually, that was my choice, and I completely endorse it, so I had no problem with that.
Too practical. That's a classic academic observation.
Indeed. but not the best feedback to receive if you want to pursue an academic career.
Which brings me to my next point. You did not, correct?
No.
I mean, you moved on. And what after law school, what did you do next?
I started a long work with managing European projects. So then I joined the Europäische Rechtsakademie, so the Academy of European Law in Trier, where I actually continued the work started a few years ago in Romania, where I was advising the French embassy in the rule of law and anti-corruption reforms in Romania at that time.
Wow.
So, and in ERA, I was also leading European projects, training judges on international criminal cooperation and other European-related matters. Actually, I started working and I was working while I was finishing my thesis. So it was a night shift to write it.
you're applying the things that you're studying as you're writing in the work that you've chosen to do. Practicality is of the essence. I mean, that if it's not practical, then it's not useful, right?
Yeah, sharing knowledge and experience is for me very key, and it's at in the core of who I am and what I'm doing. And I truly believe that, for example, when I'm delivering training or classes, because I still do, it is really important to bring an added value to your audience. Because now the basic knowledge, the references could be found everywhere. It's all over the place. So the added value of an expert should be sharing your vision and your experience, how to use these tools and how to combine all these frameworks.
I see. You've worked in technical assistance programs for the EU, the UN, in the fight against corruption, terror financing, improving governance, and carrying out justice reform. That sounds like where your added value and your expert vision would be extremely valuable.
I hope there are other fields where my vision as an expert could be useful. But yeah, this leading these programs or these projects brought me, I feel really privileged, because in working in or leading this project, I had the opportunity to work with the best in class of the top prosecutors, magistrates, lawyers from European and non-European countries. We could work closely with public administration and especially enforcement agencies or administration facing concrete issues, and that was great to share this experience with all these experts and these national public servants or magistrates, having to set up new institutions, design new policies. So that was at the same time very challenging, but it was so energizing as well.
I can imagine. And building trust, I mean, you mentioned early in your work on your doctorate, your ability to open some doors in industry and among public officials. I know as a journalist how hard that is to build trust and to gain people's faith that you're going to be using their information for good causes. And it sounds like you're doing the same thing with the prosecutors, magistrates, and lawyers that you've mentioned. Your relationship with them is such that you gave them full confidence that they could trust you and then they could really bring you into the inner circle.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you for acknowledging it. And I think it's also part of me, and this is how I operate. I never lie. I'm always conducting all my activities in full transparency. So I'm not hiding anything because I have nothing to hide. And if I need an information for a given purpose, I will clearly mention it in my approach. And same when we were on the field, that I was always insisting on the mutual benefit in having a strong cooperation, understanding as well that you cannot get 100% of your partner from the really beginning, especially in some geographical areas where you need to win the trust of your partner. Yeah. It's not a due. You need to catch it.
Yeah.
So yes. And again, that's what I liked in all these years in the different geographies where I could work.
So this podcast, the Pencast, focuses on customs innovation, broadly speaking. What would you say are some of the ways in which your work intersects with customs activities?
I don't really differentiate trade compliance and customs. For me, this is part of the same thing. Maybe people more specialized on customs may have a more technical approach of a given situation, mm-hmm. where trade compliance will have a macro vision of the situation. Maybe. But at the end of the day, we both need the more developments in artificial intelligence, for instance, and deep data. Mm-hmm. There are two technologies I really believe will bring a new advancement, new progresses in our fields. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because for the and this is where maybe in trade compliance, you can make a difference between a junior person and a senior one. Mm-hmm. The main difference is the age. And why? Because you can rely on what happened years ago. At the beginning of the conversation, you mentioned my thesis, and it's very interesting to witness now that in this paper, I described the relationship between, for example, countries like North Korea, Pakistan, and Iran in terms of ballistic proliferation. And this is more or less what we are witnessing now with Russia, Iran, and China. You have a very similar triangle of suppliers here for the same result: strategic connections and strategic proliferation. Now with drones, missiles, and cruise missiles, especially.
You gave a talk at the OECD entitled Countering Violent Kleptocracies, Natural Resource Integrity in a War-Fraught Era, stressing how valuable natural resources are used to finance war and human rights atrocities worldwide, and in particular, how Russia's lucrative diamonds, gold, and mining interests have continued to help finance its war efforts despite widespread sanctions and product bans. Could you describe some of the longstanding loopholes in sourcing guidelines and sanctions enforcement this problem reveals, and some of the steps that businesses, financial institutions, and policymakers need to take to plug these loopholes?
That's a very good question, but I think we are close to the end of the year 2023, and since you referred to the OECD debate, I mean, I was mentioning there that 2024 will be again a pivotal year in terms of compliance. The main reason for me, and if we think or if we take the EU perspective, is the upcoming EU directive criminalizing sanction evasion. That will be definitely a game changer on the European landscape. And my wish is for 2024 that since we are talking together, we have people somewhere in Europe also thinking about a strategy, an implementation strategy for this directive. I'm just making an hypothesis here that we have prosecutors from EU member states, maybe the EPPO, working together to give guidance then to the judiciary on how to apply the directive for having a much more coherent and global action at the EU level. It's true that for the time being, the US are continuing their enforcement actions, which are very known and which are quite deterrent in a way for the business to evade sanctions. And I think all the speeches delivered by the DOG or the different agencies in the US are very consistent in saying the business is the first line of defense regarding sanction evasion and enforcement, and we should closely partner together to make these sanctions and regulations enforced, and otherwise we will come with fines and penalties. So
the
rules are really clear, and the trends are almost aligned between the US and the EU, or will be in a close future. So, yes, in a year or so, we may have the same conversation, but the assessment could be completely different.
That's an exciting prospect. Are there categories of companies that repeatedly and willfully violate sanctions that are in some way more powerfully deterred now, or are we still waiting for a binding legal framework?
The question of the willfully evasion is key here, because as you know, this is the main difference between a full liability or having the obligation to demonstrate that the evasion is the result of a willfully and willingly action. Again, I think the future months will tell us more about the ability of the judiciary in Europe to open the or to prosecute the cases, and the current situation with all these circumvention cases appearing in the public domain are also showing that we need it.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm thinking in particular of recent reports of suspicious import-export data in Turkey, which seem to suggest sanctions evasions, including such products as cruise missiles, drones, and helicopters. Is that something that has come up on your radar as a major point of concern?
Sure, because since the 11th sanction package, I mean, sanctions circumvention became a key component of the strategy on sanctions. And that's really new for the EU, not for the US. and the other allies, but for the EU, it's quite new. And I think here we should differentiate two categories. On one hand, we have the networks sustained and supported by the Russia intelligence. And on the other hand, you have opportunistic people looking at the market, maybe not having a clue about the consequences of the transactions they will conclude, but there is money to do, and they move forward.
Right.
So that's the complexity of the addressing this problem, knowing that indeed in this third country's jurisdiction, out of the political pressure the EU or the US could put on these countries, there is few ways to get the full cooperation of the country, knowing that they will not close their borders completely, and that there are other other ways to transship the goods. Mm-hmm. But on that regard, the recent trends could make us more optimistic for the future. We can see the UAE adapting or taking measures to tackle the issues because of their situation in the gray list of the FATF. Small countries like Seychelles, or which have appeared in the public press, didn't like it, and again now are much more addressing the issue. So things are moving.
Mm-hmm. Public perception does play a major role here.
I think so. Yeah. The way sanctions are presented publicly or to the global audience, let's say, is really creating a false perception on their concrete results. Mm. Well, it's perfectly understandable because of having the politicians in need of creating a shock to demonstrate that they are doing something to, in the case of Russia, to address the invasion, and to, even though we are not involved militarily, to make sure that we are doing something to support Ukraine, mm-hmm. and to decrease the threat from Russia. But on the other hand, there is the reality, and the reality of the text themselves offering legal ways to continue trading with Russia in certain cases. And that's where we can find some discrepancies. In addition to these sanctions not being globally applied. We have a lot of countries disagreeing with these sanctions, and in the global south, especially, and because these sanctions are not fully backed by the UN Council.
Right. And another point that you made earlier about businesses being the first line of defense is true. But on the other hand, if you look at the AI weapons systems that have since the Gaza war surged in Israeli imports, reportedly Israel is using AI-driven technologies to target many thousands of Palestinians. Is there a concern here that businesses are leading the way before there is a framework to understand or a general global agreement on AI weapon systems?
That's a very good question, and It was already a valid question 20 years ago in my thesis, and that's the same trend here. I mean, technologies are progressing faster than the legal framework for practical considerations. So that's where it is problematic, because indeed you can pick, and this is what we observe now in the Ukraine and in Gaza as well, where you have civilian technologies easily tweaked or manipulated in a way to develop new category of weapons, or with offering military usage.
I see.
Where you have, for example, you have the Ukrainian army taking some civilian commodities and just bringing some changes, modifications to develop new military capacities.
Sure, exactly. So again, in order to prevent that sort of thing from happening, you basically have to shut down entire industries. Yeah, drones, for instance.
Yeah, and that could be also the dilemma of some industries, where you have to decide whether to ship technologies with, the main issue in export controls is that some technologies are embedding capacities within them. And then it depends of the end users. And then we go back to the business again. You need to know the whole chain, and we in compliance, we very often insist on KYC, know your customers.
Right.
And now it becomes more and more crucial, also in terms of export controls, where, for example, the US are increasing their programs of the trusted customers.
Right. Yeah, literally becomes a matter of life and death. So a slight pivot here. The World Trade Organization, which recently published a report describing how trade relationships are being reshaped by the war in Ukraine. And the report observes that globalization is not ending, but that new trade routes are appearing. Could you describe some of those new trade routes a bit?
Yeah, it's directly linked to what we were talking about. It's a matter of trust. If you are dealing with the most sensitive commodities or technologies, it's then maybe it could be good to think twice before exporting them to areas or countries where they could become a threat. And so that's how maybe now we should look at the some very specific trade transactions, especially in strategic goods or strategic technologies, and the main example is given by AUKUS, so the military alliance between the US, UK, and Australia. Internally, they develop a specific license to have these transactions operated with more flexibility, and in order to make sure that the strategic supply will be operated on time. And without the burden of the export control. So that's how we should look at these changes in the international trade. Based on where the cursor of the export control will be put, that will give you the reference of where your country sits in terms of mutual trust with a given country.
This WTO report that I mentioned also discusses clustering versus de-risking. Is this a related theme?
This is what we described. It's much more a matter of you will have countries. I don't like this this sentence, but let's use it. The like-minded countries, whatever it should describe, but they recognize themselves, each other, and they will apply or they will liberalize the trade of the most sensitive products among them, contrary to applying stringent rules when trading out of these clusters. That's the idea.
Got it. Okay. I sense in passing that you dislike terms like like-minded countries, rogue states. Yeah.
Yeah, because they are, I mean, we know what we are talking about. But then in using these words, we are also creating blocks and we are opposing them. And that could be also risky.
Right. And we're glissading over a whole bunch of divisions among these like-minded countries and a whole bunch of distinctions in the rogue states that really are important. Since this is a podcast about customs technologies and innovations, I ask everyone this kind of global crystal ball question. What innovations in custom technology do you see being the most vitally important for societies to protect themselves from malicious actors, maintain revenues, and facilitate free flow of goods? What are the things that you would most want to see if you had a magic wand in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think we touched upon the matter already, and I mentioned artificial intelligence and deep data. Combined all together, they should offer more opportunities to fasten the strategic approach on customers and transactions, and to bring them together as well. Because the most complicated task we have in trade compliance is to be capable to analyze a single transaction, but to put it in the global picture as well. Because one single transaction doesn't mean anything, but if you have a tool capable of bringing all the elements together and then telling you that at the end of the day, these transactions are part of a single network of transactions allowing a given country to build up its military capacities, it's a different bargain. So I think here the technology could play a role in first helping us identifying the threats, and secondly, speeding up the process, and then easing the trade and transactions.
I see. So you're mapping transactions, customers, types of goods in a way that reveals patterns that are more broadly applied.
Exactly. Yeah, indeed.
We discussed the ways in which legal frameworks tend to trail technological advances. Somehow it seems we need to have a way of bridging that gap, of increasing the speed at which our laws and our regulations adapt to technological advances.
Indeed. And maybe also another option could be that some industries should reset the way they think their markets, and they should include from the really beginning that they will not ship to, they will not sell their products to some areas of the world. Maybe since we are talking about sanctions and export controls, it's also a matter of standards. And we also witnessed in the past, for example, with North Korea, that you could reach your objectives in using commodities being below the standards. So you see, it's much more a matter. That's why, for example, in my thesis, but I'm also thinking that now the key question is also the knowledge. So that's why intangibles become more and more important. Because goods, commodities, you can provide them from everywhere. It could take time, maybe it would take longer than expected, but yeah, in most of the cases you need a specific knowledge, and now this is where we could put some maybe a stop, or we can slow down some military programs with these rogue states.
We've just barely started this conversation, and it's already time to wrap up. I really appreciate your taking the time with Damien to chat with me today about your multifaceted and challenging work. And of course, this has only been just a brief overview of the depth and breadth of your work. I do want to point listeners who want to know more about your activities to visit the Corporate Crime Observatory, to look at some of your many publications. I'll be doing a blog where I list some of your book and other things and your public appearances, and maybe look you up on LinkedIn as well, which is a valuable resource.
Thank you for the conversation, Tom. It was my pleasure, and indeed I tend to speak too much, I know, but I'm also so passionate by the topic that I could speak for hours. So thanks for the invitation.
Well, thank you very much. And you by no means spoke too much. I wish we had another hour or two to continue this, maybe in a future conversation.
Who knows?
Thank you very, very much.
Welcome, Tom.
And you've been listening to Pushing the Envelope, Life at the Cutting Edge of Customs Innovation, a podcast that profiles leaders in customs and their views, ideas, and inspirations about the future of customs innovation. Join us for our next Pencast, for another insightful conversation with customs trendsetters and forward thinkers. Thank you.